You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Get to people, yeah.
What are you gonna
are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe. Civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Ma'afa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Ma'afa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement: Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted, and we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi. Hotep family, hope everything was well with you today. Hope you're going to have a good weekend. I hope you get a chance to do all the things you want to do, should do, must do, can do, and will do. And I hope the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But of course, if it's not and it has to be done, you must get it done, you will get it done. That's right. And you'll do it safely. You'll be masked up and gloved up and distanced and everything like that. But it'll get done because that's the kind of brother and sister that you is. And that's why we love you. You're listening to African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, or any other time around the world. If you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives at timeforanawakening.com, where you'll see at the top of the page, podcast, and you click on that, and there are the drop-down. You'll see the drop-down. It'll say African Perspectives. You click on that, and then there will be programs that are dated entitled. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media. Once again, this program every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And all times are going to give our Eastern times. On Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds Public Affairs Programming out of Philadelphia with Brother Jihad Ahmed. Followed by from 8 to 9, Black Therapy Central with Dr. Mawia Kamban and Nataki Kamban. That's followed by from 9 to 10, Conversations, Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey from Encobra. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Tuesdays. On Thursdays at 7 p.m. from 7 to 9, Melanin Live with host Chief Lance Jones and Sister Bonisiwa Ayan. It's Friday? Oh, well, if it's Friday and it's 9 p.m. Eastern, excuse me, if it's Friday and it's 8 p.m. Eastern, it's time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Fridays. On Saturdays, Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers at 4 p.m. from 4 to 6. And at 7 p.m. from 7 to 9, the Sankofa Elders Council. On Sunday at 7 p.m., once again, it's time for an awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And the number to call is 215-490-9832, 215-490-9832. We Buy Black. That's right. We Buy Black, brothers and sisters. Get everything. The largest online marketplace for American African-owned businesses is WeBuyBlack.com. Get everything you need from American African-owned businesses from WeBuyBlack.com. Africa for the Africans, Brother Bomani Tayemba, took about 35 of us to Ghana. Just got back on the 5th. And already he has posted the pictures on Facebook.com/Bomani and the videos, YouTube.com/Bomani2007 that you could see for yourself. And, of course, from some previous tours. So check out Africa for the Africans. Go to AfricaForTheAfricans.org and everything that you need, you know, to have a trip of a lifetime. He has a trip upcoming, April 2nd through the 12th, going to Senegal and Gambia. That's followed by a trip coming up in May, May 24th to June 4th to Ghana. And then November 18th through the 29th of November to Tanzania. So, and these are all very affordable. So check it out. AfricaForTheAfricans.org. Baba Rinoco. His trip has been postponed.
He is going to be on the program next week, Friday. Baba Renoko Rashidi will be on with me next week, Friday, and give you some updates on what's happening with him and some of the things that he's doing and things that he is planning. Habesha, HabeshaIncorporated.org. Of course, Habesha is a Pan-African organization that cultivates leadership in youth and families through practical experiences. And that's why I tell you, Habesha is the bomb. You know, culture, education, sustainable agriculture, entrepreneurship, holistic health and technology. And, of course, the Kashi Project that is taking place in Ghana. That is taking place in Ghana. And so, Habesha. The Ledge Group, brothers and sisters. Go online, theledgegroup.com. Ledge, the Ledge Group, land for the environmental development of group economics, dealing with the four things that sustain us as human beings, food, water, clothing, and shelter, providing that on the continent. Over 12 projects in six countries, 172 people employed globally, and over 260 members. You also should become a member of the Ledge Group to support what they are doing to help our brothers and sisters. The Ledge Group. Wadada's Healthy Market and Juice Bar, located in the West End here in Atlanta. I'm Ralph David Abernathy, across the street from Soul Veg and up the street from the Shrine of the Black Madonna, which will still be open for the next 2 weekends, open on Friday and Saturdays, opening on Fridays and Saturdays at the Shrine, where you can pick up all kinds of stuff from the Shrine. You got books, you know, you got jewelry, you got furniture, you got, you name it, clothing. Of course, the red, black, and green shoes at the Shrine of the Black Madonna. Mama Nia at the Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall has made her move. She's not open yet, of course, and she plans on opening at the end of the month. The Medu Bookstore, her number will be the same at 404-346-3263. 404-346-3263. It's a bigger location, and it's going to be very nice, I know. That's the Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall. The other bookstore we promote is the Black Dot Cultural Center and Bookstore in Lithonia. That is east of here, east of Atlanta. My good brother Gazimde Ajamu is the proprietor. Give him a call at 404-519-8107. 404-519-8107. The Black Dot Cultural Center and Bookstore. There is light in the Black Dot, brothers and sisters. Us Lifting Us, the Economic Development Cooperative for Our People in the Spirit of Ujamaa Cooperative Economics, or as we like to say, Family Center Economics. Their Thursday night broadcast last night from 9 to 10 on Blog Talk Radio. That's blogtalkradio.com/ULU. The name of the program is Dare to Win. Us Lifting Us, the Economic Development Cooperative for Our People. And that's from 9 to 10. If you want to call just to listen, cool. But if you want to call to give questions, comments, or concerns, dial 929-477-2789. That's 929-477-2789. Sister Gabrielle Aurelia is doing outstanding work in the northeastern portion of the island of Haiti, the rural area of Haiti. And of course, considering the devastation, they're still dealing with the earthquake of 10 years ago. I mean, it's just, so, you know, they're not getting a lot of resources up that way. And so they're relying on people like myself and you to lend a hand to help those young brothers and sisters in the northeastern portion of the island of Haiti. Go to Sanjay, SONJAY-HAITI.org. Sanjay-Haiti. Look at the beautiful children. They deal with education. They deal with health, sustainable agriculture, entrepreneurship, and they deserve to be supported. Akabin Institute. Make your check or money order out to Akabin Institute. Send it to P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. That's Akabin Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia 30310. But you also can use PayPal and Cash App. PayPal, $YAA, the letter M, then Baruti, B-A-R-U-T-I, and make a constant donation. Also, too, if you want to get books by Bubba Rudy, he's a prolific writer, and many books, go to AkabinHouse.com, AkabinHouse.com. Anya, Mama Baruti, her program is, they have Bubba Baruti and Ya Baruti have a program February 6th. Her program is from 4 to 6 p.m., And the topic is When a Woman Heals. This is a quarterly online African womanhood discussion. And it is from 4 to 6. Donation is $10, $5 for young ladies. And, of course, the mechanisms to join this Zoom call is to make sure the donation, $10 and $5. And then you can use PayPal. If you use PayPal, you put in YaBaruti at yahoo.com. If you use Cash App, $Ya, the letter M, Baruti. Include the pertinent information, Quarterly Sister Circle. Put in Quarterly Sister Circle, then your name and the email address that you want the streaming link to be sent to. The same thing for Bubba Baruti. He also is on the Saturday, the 6th, from 12 noon to 3. And this is the Rites of Fundamentals, developing an effective rites of passage program for our young men. And, you know, not just boys, but even us as men, an effective program. And that's going to be, once again, Saturday, February 6th, from 12 noon to 3 before Mama Ya Baruti's presentation. And the donation is $20 for warrior men and $10 for warriors in training. This is a longer program and more intense. And the men's quarterly gathering. And make your donation, $20 in training and $10 for to PayPal, Ya Baruti at Yahoo, or Cash App, $ Ya M Baruti. Include the pertinent information, the 5th quarterly men's gathering, and your name and your email address to make sure you can send the link to. All right. The Enye Sesem of Daily Revolutionary Thought. The Enye Sesem of Daily Revolutionary Thought. January 14th. If you and a fool have an argument, the fool succeeds. An African proverb. Yes, discussion plays a significant role in the practical and visionary and political and intellectual development of the frontliners, but there are limits to this beyond which conversation becomes harmful to the warrior's thinking. In assessing these limits, it is important to understand why we should refuse to waste our time arguing with Yorugu or Negroes and other seriously confused types because drama undermines sovereignty. The answer becomes clear once we recognize the unscrupulous nature of their intent. Experience has taught them that if they cannot engage you in a conversation, then they cannot convince you that they are sane. Their job is to have us repeatedly waste our time in meaningless, distractive, reactive, dysfunctional anger, frustration, and blind bewilderment as they consciously continue forward in their evasive, Euro-visualizing, destructive, hateful, and genocidal way. And we have to understand the politics involved. Pain, pleasure, or anywhere in between, everything is political for Yorugu in their drive to create reality in their own dead, despiritualized image. Enough of us were taught to teach the ignorant but ignore the willfully stupid to grasp this simple truth. It makes common African sense. So, yes, in an effort to maintain our African sanity in the face of anti-African onslaught, we have every right and reason to be closed-minded to the Urugu and any mendicide-inducing illogic derived from it. We are not Urugu. We have no desire to think like the Urugus. We know that to embrace the Uruguan way is to embrace them. Affirm, I do not engage with fools. Affirm, I do not argue with fools. January 15th, we brought nothing upon ourselves. Quick to internalize our pain, taking the blames, afraid to point the fingers at those who try to tame our spirit. African proverb. We debate, and then we debate about the debates. And then we debate about the debates about the debates. Meanwhile, those of us who are not consumed by debates of debates, who have awakened to the consuming waste and energy involved, realize the extent of this regression. We are in a worse situation after the debates, over the debates of the debates, than before. It is a realization that can help us to understand that the debates are part of the distraction, a diversion, an exciting outlet from the boredom of our dispossession, and even increasing regression, entertaining excitement that Urugu has us caught up in while they continue their progressive invasion, genocidal assault against our very existence. Realizing this can help us to understand the depths of our functional powerlessness, how we are seeking power in a powerless way, in terms of purpose relative to debating. Warriors are not here for those kinds of battles. They are here to build. So warriors have to know that if debating is all that those who cross your path can do, if that is the only way that they can communicate, then they need to be removed from their space. You need to remove them from your space. Warriors are here to do concrete work, nation build, as best as they can with what they have and what they know. They are not here to be distracted by divisive, childish play. Affirm, I do not waste my time in meaningless, distractive debate. Affirm, I do not waste my time in meaningless, distractive debate. January 16th. Violence was an instructive component of these strategies, whether on the part of the direct victims of the larger population. If nothing else, the need for shackles, guns, ropes, chains, iron balls, whips, and cannons that sustain a vulnerable European Union of slave-traded related jobs eloquently tells a story of opposition from the hinterland to the high seas. A change in appearance or behavior is not necessarily indicative of a conversion of the heart, especially when it comes to individual representatives of a people always search into their collective historical patterns for their truth. Never trust an individual with a people's thought and behavior. Do not confuse a sampling enthusiastic turning to the sun or the same slower and more mature movement of the force in which it exists today with the expansive, evasive movement of its countless previous genetically entwined generations. The nutrients out of which its new trees gain the energy to sprout and develop come from their fertilizer form, from the remains of its past trees. So only by studying backwards can you ascertain the forest's truth. Similarly, for human growth and human groups, or those pretending to be, only historical patterns will reveal true intent and character, unlike what they may individually or collectively say or do now in order to manage your impression of them. Their historical patterns do not lie. Their historical patterns do not lie. Affirm, I remain in opposition to Urugu's evasive, genocidal, enslaving onslaught. Affirm, I remain in opposition to Urugu's invasive, genocidal, enslaving assault. The Inye Sesem of daily revolutionary thought. Yes, sir. That's deep. Happy birthday. To the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, who would have been 92 years old today. You know, Dr. King was phenomenal, a phenomenal man. I know for me coming up at that time, I had embraced Malcolm. I began to look at the more radical side of our struggle and began to have a sense of that direction. I guess because I, you know, kind of sensed that there's nothing we can really do or say to change what Caucasians think, feel, and what they do, you know. And the years has since proven such. You know, when he was killed April 4th, 1968, it's one of those days like now will be for a lot of these folks, January 6th. Will be another day that will live in infamy, like many other days of December 7th, 41, you know, September 11th of 2001. You know, these horrific things that happened. February 21st, 65 was another day that I remember distinctly when El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz was assassinated at the Audubon Ballroom. A lot of these things. But King was a brother who really loved us. But I believe because of his being a minister in Christianity, there's always this hope for all mankind. Believe that all mankind can come together and there can be true brotherly love and true sharing of the wealth and sharing of the planet and its resources, where human beings will mobilize where there is issues and problems to come correct those things, famines, destitute, poverty, so forth. It's a good thing to think of, and it, you know, from a human standpoint, but when you have human beings, and you know, I don't believe that human beings are inherently evil or inherently bad, but I believe that environment a lot of times makes human beings think and do things in a way that sometimes could be detrimental. That's why now I talk about the European, the Caucasian, the Urugu. I talk about his evolutionary development in Europe, where it's different. And all you have to do is look up Dr. Sheikh Anta Diop in his two cradle theory of human development of the northern cradle, where Europeans began to develop humanly. In a southern cradle, where we came from. And not understanding that, you think that we're all the same, we're all human. And of course, the way things shake out, you sometimes now you see that we are not. We're human beings, but in terms of how we behave, how we interact, things that we do, and these are collective. And so I'm going to play this speech, an interview on NBC about 10 so months before April 4th, 1965. So this is probably, you know, the middle of maybe summer, the summer of 1964. It's an interesting interview. It's also the one that he talks about a number of things, the three things that this government has involved itself in, the three evils. He also talks about what the government has done for people unlike us and failed and seriously failed to do for us. I think that Dr. King, and he even says it in his speech about integrating into a burning building, but that's what he said to Harry Belafonte, you know, and he said, I believe I'm trying to integrate my people into a burning building. And to me, and he has said profound things, but to me that was most profound because it was right. This is a burning building. This is a terrible situation here in America. As you had just seen what happened. To me, there is no hope for this country unless something radically changes. The economic inequality that was established long after King's death, particularly brought on and exacerbated by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, have put the Europeans in such an economic vantage. No, not all of them, but yes, to some degree, they all benefit, even the poor ones. It's just like Johnson said in his Southern strategy. You're better than any, you know, somebody black, they got money. You better than it because you're white. That attitude, that mentality is still in the minds of Caucasians, the Urugu. So I want you to listen, and then we'll take a break. It'll come upon that, and then there's a few quotes I want to say by Dr. King, and please join the conversation if you have something that you want to talk about as it relates to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and today being his birthday. Let's engage in that conversation. And then Monday, on the day that is the quote holiday, we'll talk about that as well and that impact, you know.
Civil Rights, King, Van Oker, Roll 20, Sound 36.
Dr. King, this church is as good a place as any to go back over your commitment to the civil rights movement. When you went out from here into university and then you went to Montgomery, Alabama and started the bus boycotts there, what was the philosophy of the civil rights movement as you saw it then, more than 10 years ago?
Well, I would say then the philosophy was that we must go all out to use legal and nonviolent methods to gain full citizenship rights for the Negro people of our country. Now, of course, that particular struggle and that philosophy centered on breaking down all of the barriers of legal segregation. So I would say that in that period, the basic thrust for the gaining of citizenship rights for Negroes was to end the humiliation surrounding the whole system of legal segregation.
Dr. King, was there something peculiar to the place where you started and the kind of people you attracted? I mean by that, there was a strong attachment on the part of your parishioners in Montgomery to the church. They were older people, weren't they?
Yes, I would say by and large they were older people who participated in the boycott because they were the ones using the bus more than anybody else. And Montgomery was a community predominantly church-centered, so that it was very easy to get to the vast majority of Negroes because they were in some way connected with a church in the community.
Sir, in addition to your commitment to the idea of nonviolence, wasn't it also the only thing you could do, the white community having the monopoly on violence, that if you had tried violence, they would have met it with violence? It was the only device open to you, wasn't it?
Well, I'll put it another way, that morally, I was led to nonviolence because I felt that it was the best moral way to deal with the problem. We were seeking to establish a just society. And it was my feeling then, and it is my feeling now, that violence is certainly much more socially destructive, and it creates many more social problems than it solves. So I was led to nonviolence for deep moral reasons. Now, there is no doubt about the fact that in our struggle in Montgomery and all over the United States, for that matter, nonviolence is also practically sound. It would just be impractical for the Negro to turn to violence. He has neither the instruments nor the techniques of violence. We are about 10 or 11% of the total population of the nation, and I would say we are about 0.1% of the firepower. So it would just be totally impractical and unwise and unrealistic for the Negro to think of violence. Well, I saw this in the beginning in Montgomery, but this wasn't the basic reason that I turned to nonviolence and that I believed in it as a philosophy. I turned to it because I felt that it was the morally excellent way to deal with the problem of racial injustice in our country.
Is there something about nonviolence that made it, and I use that in the past tense, that made it more useful among Southern Negroes than the ghetto Negroes of the North?
I wouldn't say there's anything that makes it more useful to Southern Negroes. I think it is true that we've had more nonviolent movements in the South because the problem for many years was more crystallized and, in a sense, more visible in the South. We didn't have many civil rights activities on a massive scale in the North until 3 or 4 years ago. So I would say that we just haven't had a chance to experiment on a broad scale with nonviolence in the Northern ghetto. I have the feeling that nonviolence is as applicable and workable in the Northern ghetto as it is in the South. Now, there's a larger job there. The frustrations at points are much deeper. The bitterness is deeper. And I think that's because in the South we can see pockets of progress here and there. We've really made some strides that are very visible, and every Southern Negro knows that he can do things today that he couldn't do 4 or 5 years ago. Wherein in the North, the Negro sees only retrogress, and he doesn't find it as easy to get his vision centered on his target, the target of opposition, as he does in the South. Consequently, this is made for despair, and at many points cynicism, a feeling that you can't win, and it simply means that we've got to develop in the North a massive job of organization and mobilizing forces and resources to deal with the problem in the urban ghettos of the North, just as we've done it in the South.
Well, in the South, particularly in Alabama, you had visible villains, Jim Clark, Bull Connor, cattle prods, police dogs. But in the North, you don't have those visible villains. Isn't it hard to get your people aroused and directed at something that isn't visible?
Well, that's exactly right, and this is what I was saying when I said it's harder to see your target. In the South, in the nonviolent movement, we were aided always, on the whole, by the brutality of our opponent. It isn't the same way in the North. The other thing is that you don't have legal segregation in the North as you do in the South. So it is much more difficult to get people to see exactly what you're doing, but it isn't an impossible job. It's a hard, it's a tedious job at times to get people to be aroused from their apathetic slumbers, but I still feel that Negroes in the North can be motivated just as they were motivated in the South. And I think as time goes on with the growing economic deprivation in the Negro community, it will even be easier because people will come to see that not only is something wrong in general, but something is wrong in particular in their own economic and housing situations.
Well, what is it? I mean, how do you find it? It's very subtle in the North, is it not?
It's subtle, but it's becoming much more visible. Anybody can see that the schools are more segregated in the North today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court rendered its decision declaring segregation unconstitutional. Anybody can look around the ghetto and see that ghetto schools are predominantly segregated and devoid of quality. Anyone who moves through a major ghetto of our country will see the housing conditions. People don't have to be reminded that they are forced to live in slums in many instances, and they're often rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. And it isn't too hard to see the exploitation that the Negro confronts in the ghetto, where he is forced to pay more for less and constantly trying to make ends meet, but because of either no job as a result of unemployment or a job that is so economically unprofitable that the person can't make ends meet. And I think they see all of these things, and more they are coming to see them, because before the people of the North were looking to the South and they supported the struggles of the South. Now they are coming to see that their problems are very real and they've got to organize to grapple with them.
Was there something hypocritical about the fact that the South existed and the North could point the finger? And then when the Civil Rights Acts were passed in the early 60s, you couldn't point the finger anymore?
Well, there was no doubt about the hypocrisy of large segments of the nation on the whole question of racial equality. I think the best example is that many of the senators from the North and the West, and congressmen generally, who voted for civil rights legislation in 64 and even 65 of the Voting Rights Bill, refused last year to vote for civil rights legislation because it dealt with an issue applicable to the North, the whole housing question. And this, it seems to me, was the greatest expression of the hypocrisy of many of our citizens and many of the senators and congressmen of the North.
But isn't that part of the dilemma now? That people knew that Negroes were being denied what was guaranteed to them by the Constitution, by the fact that they were citizens of this country. Then when they were given those rights, do you feel the white community said, well, we've given them all that we have, now it's up to them?
Well, I think the dilemma is much deeper, and I think one during this period of transition has to be very honest with America. And honesty impels me to admit that America has broad racist elements still alive. Racism is still existing in American society in many areas of the society, North and South. And the other thing is that there has never been a single, solid, determined commitment of large segments of white America on the whole question of racial equality. I think we have to see that vacillation has always existed, ambivalence has always existed, and this to me is the so-called white backlash. It's merely a new name for an old phenomenon. I see the white backlash as a continuation of the same ambivalence and vacillation of white America on the whole question of racial justice that has existed since the founding of our nation. I think the other thing that we must see at this time is that many of the people who supported us in Selma, in Birmingham, were really outraged about the extremist behavior toward Negroes. But they were not at that moment, and they are not now, committed to genuine equality for Negroes. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee an annual income, for instance, to get rid of poverty for Negroes and all poor people. It's much easier to integrate a bus than it is to make genuine integration a reality and quality education a reality in our schools. It's much easier to integrate even a public park than it is to get rid of slums. And I think we are in a new era, a new phase of the struggle, where we have moved from a struggle for decency, which characterized our struggle for 10 or 12 years, to a struggle for genuine equality. And this is where we are getting the resistance, because there was never any intention to go this far. People were reacting to Bull Connor and to Jim Clark rather than acting in good faith for the realization of genuine equality.
Do you think white people in this country, and I'm talking about non-segregationist people devoid or thinking they're devoid of racism, do you have any idea of what they want the Negro to be in America?
Well, it depends on the level that we are talking here, because I think you have to make a distinction between the people who are genuinely and absolutely committed in the white community on the question of racial equality. And I must confess that I think they're in a very small minority. I think the vast majority of white Americans will go but so far. It's a kind of installment plan for equality, and they're always looking for an excuse to go but so far.
Why are they looking for the excuse? What is it about the Negro? I mean, every other group that came as an immigrant somehow, not easily, but somehow got around it. Is it just the fact that Negroes are black?
That's a part of it, and growing, that grows out of something else. You can't thingify anything without depersonalizing that something. If you use something as a means to an end, at that moment you make it a thing and you depersonalize it. The fact is that the Negro was a slave in this country for 244 years. That act, that was a willful thing that was done. The Negro was brought here in chains, treated in very inhuman fashion. And this led to the thingification of the Negro. So he was not looked upon as a person. He was not looked upon as a human being with the same status and worth as other human beings. And the other thing is that human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually rationalizing that wrong. So slavery was justified morally, biologically, theoretically, scientifically, everything else. And it seems to me that white America must see that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. That is one thing that other immigrant groups haven't had to face. The other thing is that the color became a stigma. American society made the Negro's color a stigma. And that can never be overlooked. So I think these things are absolutely necessary. The other thing is that America freed the slaves in 1863 through the Emancipation Proclamation of Abraham Lincoln, but gave the slaves no land or nothing in reality, and as a matter of fact, to get started on. At the same time, America was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that there was a willingness to give the white peasants from Europe an economic base. And yet it refused to give its black peasants from Africa, who came here involuntarily in chains and had worked free for 244 years, any kind of economic base. And so emancipation for the Negro was really freedom to hunger. It was freedom to the winds and rains of heaven. It was freedom without food to eat or land to cultivate, and therefore it was freedom and famine at the same time. And when white Americans tell the Negro to lift himself by his own bootstraps, They don't look over the legacy of slavery and segregation. I believe we ought to do all we can and seek to lift ourselves by our own bootstraps. But It's a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And many Negroes, by the thousands and millions, have been left bootless as a result of all of these years of oppression and as a result of a society that deliberately made his color a stigma and something worthless and degrading.
Apart from wanting to live better, which all of us want to do, to raise one's children in a better way, to be better, does the Negro in America know what he wants to be?
I'm convinced that almost every Negro in this country, other than those who have been so scarred by the system that they've become pathological in the process, and we all have to battle with pathology, nobody really knows what it means to be a Negro unless one can really experience it. And I know we all have to battle with this constant drain of a feeling of nobodiness. But in spite of this, I think the vast majority of Negroes in this country know that they want to be people, they want to be men, they want equality, period. It just boils down to that. And we haven't been able to be people. We haven't been men because of all of the conditions that we've lived with and the syndrome of deprivation surrounding conditions, whether it's in housing, in the economic area, or in schools, or in the vicious credit practices that we face in the ghetto, and all of the problems of closed doors and constant defeats. But in spite of all this, I think we all know, basically, that we want to be men. We want to be persons judged not on the basis of the color of our skin, but on the basis of the content of our character.
But you know that many young Negroes don't want anything that smacks of the American white middle class. But do they want something that smacks of whatever is the black middle class, or do they just not want bourgeois values, which after all are the basis of this democracy?
Well, I think we have to see what they are saying. I would be the first to agree that integration does not mean giving up everything that has an Afro-American taint, so to speak, a background. I think there are certain unique things within any culture and certain cultural patterns that when you get to the process of amalgamation, can really lift the whole culture. And it seems to me that integration at its best is the opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. I think the other thing that we've got to see is that these young people are saying that there must be a revolution of values in our country. As Jimmy Baldwin said on one occasion, what advantage is there in being integrated into a burning house? And I feel that there is a need for a revolution of values in America, because some of the values that presently exist are certainly out of line with the values and the idealistic structure that brought our nation into being. Unfortunately, we haven't been true to these ideals, and many of the values of so-called white middle-class society are values that need to be reviewed and re-evaluated, and in a real sense, they need to be changed. So I think the young people in the Negro community who are raising these questions are raising some very profound questions about our total society. In other words, they are saying that there must be a restructuring of the architecture of our society where values are concerned. And with this, I would agree with. So in the quest for integration, I think we can offer our whole nation something, because there are three evils in our nation. It's not only racism, but economic exploitation of poverty would be one, and then militarism. And I think in a sense, and in a very real sense, these three are tied inextricably together, and we aren't going to get rid of one without getting rid of the other.
When you stood on the Lincoln Memorial that day in August, 63, and you said, "I had a dream," did that dream envision that you could see a war in Asia preventing the federal government doing for the Negroes, preventing the society doing for the Negroes, that which you think had to be done?
No, I didn't envision that then. I must confess that that period was a great period of hope for me. And I'm sure for many others all across the nation, many of the Negroes who had about lost hope, saw a solid decade of progress in the South. And in 1954, which was, 64, 1963, 9 years after the Supreme Court's decision to be in the March on Washington, meant a great deal. It was a high moment, a great watershed moment. But I must confess that that dream that I had that day has at many points turned into a nightmare. Now, I'm not one to lose hope. I keep on hoping. I still have faith in the future. But I've had to analyze many things over the last few years, and I would say over the last few months. I've gone through a lot of soul-searching and agonizing moments. And I've come to see that we have many more difficult days ahead, and some of the old optimism was a little superficial, and now it must be tempered with a solid realism. And I think the realistic fact is that we still have a long, long way to go, and that we are involved in a war on Asian soil, which, if not checked and stopped, can poison the very soul of our nation.
Dr. King, even if there had not been a war in Asia, would you still not have had this nightmare insofar as the Negro movement for equality then touched on two things that the white community holds sacred, their children and their property?
Oh, I have no doubt that we would have encountered great difficulties, great problems of resistance if the war had not been in existence, so that I'm not going to say that all of our problems will be solved if the war in Vietnam is ended. But I do say that the war makes it infinitely more difficult to deal with these problems. When a nation becomes obsessed with the guns of war, it loses its social perspective, and programs of social uplift suffer. This is just a fact of history, so that we do face many more difficulties as a result of the war. It's much more difficult to really arouse a conscience during a time of war. I noticed the other day, some weeks ago, a Negro was shot down in Chicago, and it was a clear case of police brutality. That was on page 30 of the paper, but on page 1 at the top was 780 Viet Cong killed. That is something about a war like this that makes people insensitive. It dulls the conscience. It strengthens the forces of reaction, and it brings into being bitterness and hatred and violence, and it strengthened the military-industrial complex of our country, and it's made our job much more difficult, because I think we can go along with some programs, if we didn't have this war on our hands, that would cause people to adjust to new developments, just as they did in the South. They said they'd never ride the bus with us, blood would flow in the streets, they wouldn't go to school, and all of these things. But when people came to see that they had to do it because the law insisted, they finally adjusted. And I think white people all over this country will adjust once the nation makes it clear that in schools and housing, we've got to learn to live together as brothers. I think the biggest problem now is that we got our gains over the last 12 years at bargain rate, so to speak. Didn't cost the nation anything. In fact, it helped the economic side of the nation to integrate lunch counters and public accommodations. It didn't cost the nation anything to get the right to vote established. And now we are confronting issues that cannot be solved without costing the nation billions of dollars. Now, I think this is where we're getting our greatest resistance. They may put it on many other things, but we can't get rid of slums and poverty without it costing the nation something.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King.
Hey, NBC News viewers, thanks for checking out our YouTube channel.
Okay. From an interview on NBC back in I believe in the summer of 64. We're going to take a break. When we come back from the break, we'll have more discussion, and I hope you can join the conversation at 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. You're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com, and blacktalkradionetwork.com. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com on the birth date of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King that we need to reflect and we need to discuss. And I know the day, the commemorative day is Monday coming up, and we'll be back on the air. And but reality is this. Dr. King was a very principled man, very beautiful man. But has he seen what was happening? And he started calling into question the economic issues that are affecting us as a people in this country, the militarism. He said the three evils of racism, militarism, and economic deprivation. And when you start talking about that, then now you're becoming dangerous. When you want to integrate a lunch counter and toilets and sitting on the same bus, in fact, in the reality, it became more economic. They benefited from that. In fact, many of the things that we would have for ourselves, just like the Negro League, when Jackie Robinson integrated Major League Baseball, broke the, quote, color barrier, killed the Negro League, killed the industries around that. The same thing. Now we can go into Woolworths and Sears and so forth and sit at the counter. It's the same way today. And so, you know, here we are decades later in a worse situation for us collectively as a people. It doesn't make sense, does it? It makes sense when you understand that we have been chasing a nightmare. Here are some quotes from Dr. King that, and if you, please, you want to join the conversation. If those who are on, I have a few people on, you just hit star twice. But give us a call at 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. Dr. King said, I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, the United States government. The greatest purveyor of they are the most violent. In fact, United States is the military arm of European Caucasian extremism, racism, and privilege, better known as white supremacy. The United States is the military arm of that, more so, of course, than Europe, Australia, and other places where Europeans, Caucasians, whites dominate and control. The United States have military bases across this country, around the world. They have military bases around the world, many on the continent of Africa. That's why they can strike so quickly. There is a magnificent new militancy within the Negro community all across this nation, and I welcome this as a marvelous development. The Negro of America is saying he's determined to be free and he is militant enough to stand up. And of course we did. But when we really stood up is when we started tearing stuff up. When Dr. King was killed, April 4th in 68, over 140, I believe, cities went up in flames. And of course, we had been rioting, insurrections all those many times in the 60s, in the middle 60s, Watts, Newark, Chicago, 68, 69, Milwaukee, almost every city, there was an uprising. The Kerner Commission, what did the Kerner Commission say? The Kerner Commission said it would be said the same thing today. Just like this Caucasian named Andrew Hacker wrote a book. in the 90s. Andrew Hacker. Two nations, separate, hostile, and unequal. That's what the Kerner Commission was saying at that time. And it's exacerbated by the economic inequality that is so deep. Nothing will change. And in fact, they will not. It is for us to change. You can't talk about solving economic problems of the Negro without talking about billions of dollars. You can't talk about ending the slums without first saying profit must be taken out of the slums. You're really tempering and getting on dangerous ground because you are messing with folks then. You are messing with captains of industry. Now, this means that we're treading in difficult waters because it really means that we're saying that there's something wrong with capitalism. Capitalism is an evil. The European loves capitalism. Capitalism is an evil. It is an economic system by its design that says in order for me to have all that I have, a whole bunch of y'all can't have a damn thing. Capitalism is a system. It is an evil system. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as our citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. Many of us talk about reparations. Now, you know, if you listen to this program, I don't argue for reparations for individuals getting some money. I'd shown the hell ain't down with ADOS, the descendants of slaves, and being very divisive in that manner. Because I believe that as we get our stuff together on the continent, we're going to push for reparations globally. Any and everybody who is, and we'll look at the whole situation, whoever, but particularly for Europeans because of what they have done. They have devastated us, looking at colonialism, looking at the enslavement of our people for hundreds of years. Because it is about repair, not giving the descendants of us some money. I don't know if you've heard me before in this program, but I've stated there's a Caucasian, he's passed, Charles Kuttheimer, who was an editorialist, a column. I don't know if it was a Washington paper or the New York paper. I don't know. Don't give a damn. But he said, we should give them reparations. He said this in the 80s. We should give them reparations. We gave them welfare. We gave them affirmative action. We gave them this. Give them reparations. Because with the mindset that they have, it'll be like a stimulus package. We'll get it right back. Give them 40,000 a family and 20,000 an individual. We'll be having reparation sales on Cadillacs and clothes. They won't pull the money together and build schools or institutions. They got this money now. They live in large for that minute. Give them reparations. And then after it's done, then tell them to shut the hell up. We done did everything for you. And if you don't like the treatment you get, so be it. The onus is on you. No, there's no class action lawsuits. None of that. If you suffer, you suffer. Yeah. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have never yet engaged in a direct action movement that was well-timed according to the timetable of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I've heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with a piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We must come to see with the distinguished jurist of yesterday that justice is too long delayed, is justice denied. And look at today. You see, what's interesting, when you hear the words of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, we're talking about somebody who at the height of our so-called civil rights movement was the serious voice. And when you hear his words of then, and now you compare today, objectively, I ain't talking about a few of us who, you know, because I mean, they had to. This wasn't the segregation of Plessy versus Ferguson. This wasn't the segregation of the South and even in the North of the times before the civil rights movement. They had to have some brothers and sisters who had some economic wherewithal. But our condition collectively as a people is worse today than it was 40, 30 years ago. The question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be extremists to hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or the extension of justice? We want justice. We want justice. But as that saying goes, we go down there and all you see is just us. If America does not use her vast resources of wealth to end poverty and make it possible for all of God's children to have the basic necessities of life, she too will go to hell. Yes. And that's what is happening. That's what you see happening. Just like I said, when we marched in the streets peacefully, we marched because of police brutality and inequality. When these Caucasians did what they did, they lost the election and they got mad about it. They want to maintain a way of life that they want to have their security and the ability to dictate and dominate. And that is not changing. That's that right-wing conservative sector. I don't trust Biden and these liberals. It has been the liberals. That is, when Dr. King talked about wait, that's what he's talking about. Watch what happens in the next few years. Barack Obama should have told you and showed you that. But all the hope and all the belief that now we have a black man as the president of the United States, an American African as the president of the United States. Our condition became worse. Because if you are president of the United Snakes, you do the bidding of those who are in control. And you know that ain't us and never will be. The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. Many times when those things come up, those challenges come up, persons, just like he said, they cow, they scary, they scary, you know, because they can't deal with the challenges of controversy. If our economic system is to survive, there has to be a better distribution of wealth. We can't have a system where some people live in superfluous, in ordinary wealth, while others live in abject, deafening poverty. But that's the system. That's the capitalist system by its very design. It's designed so that there is a group of people, and now that group of people have billions of dollars. Billions of dollars. Oh, yes, there's an inordinate amount of millionaires. A lot of us, I think we might even have a couple of the billionaires. Billions of dollars and millions of dollars. And yet this country, in the pandemic situation, although other countries could do so, and I look at many of them could do so because of the wealth that they acquired because of the exploitation of Africa. When European country was giving out $1,500, $2,000, $3,000 a month, where this damn country gave you $1,200 and then 6 months later gave you $600. While there's so many billionaires and millionaires in this country. Yeah. The hope of a secure and livable world lies with disciplined nonconformist. Disciplined nonconformist. Who are dedicated to justice and peace and brotherhood. The trailblazers in human, academic, scientific, and religious freedom have always been nonconformists in any cause that concerns the progress of mankind. Put your faith in the nonconformists. Put your faith in those who challenge, who are outside, and who continue to talk about and demonstrate and challenge those on the inside of the evil that they do and how they continue to do it. The nonconformists are the ones. But as you can see, it falls on deaf ears. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionaries and you see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. Well, I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everyone here will cry out, yes, I'm black. I'm proud of it. I'm black and I'm beautiful. Right on, Martin. But see, I don't subscribe to the black and the proud. I subscribe to Africa. We are Africans. We are Africans. The minute and the moment that we all embrace that, no matter where we are, whether we're in Jamaica, then we Jamaican Africans. Africa is the noun. There's a word that goes in front of the noun that describes what the noun is, the adjective. If we're in America, we American Africans, Ghanaian Africans, Nigerian Africans, British Africans, French Africans, wherever we are. If that's where we are, that's Brazilian Africans. We're Africans. Oh, man, imagine if we embraced being African and all of us, whether we want to stay where we are in those places, but understand our allegiance and our heart is on the continent, and we put whatever resources for those who are going to the continent to work with our brothers and sisters on the continent to control the land and the resources on the continent, and that is our home, and that wherever we are, we have that connection, and we can go home if we want to. That's what we're doing. That's what we're building for. That's what we must build for. Nothing in the world. This is my favorite Dr. King quote. My favorite. Nothing in the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. Because it is about the mind. We are at war. We have been warred upon, and what is deep is what they have done to our minds. How we think about ourselves and think about each other, and how we go after the trappings of others, how we believe in systems and theologies that are detrimental to us. Sincere ignorance. Ignorance is not bad. Ignorance is simply absence of knowledge. You can always acquire new knowledge to end your ignorance. I'm ignorant of quantum physics. But if somebody explained quantum physics to me, or I got a primer or something that I begin to understand what quantum physics is, that would end my ignorance of quantum physics. But to be sincere, to be sincere, dedicated to ignorance, and conscientious, to be conscious, to be aware, to have knowledge of stupidity, of being stupid, and want to stay there. There's that saying, if we knew better, we do better. If we knew better, we do better. A lot of us don't want to know. We don't want to know because it requires us to do better. It requires us to change. It requires us to do something different, to challenge ourselves and each other. It requires that. So we rather waddle into stupidity and ignorance, sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. I hope you make that your favorite Dr. King quote. When I first heard it, it sure in the hell's been mine. That's many years now. I just started thinking as I'm going over this today, excuse me, sorry, that, you know, some of the things that I've done associate with being on the fire department in my 31 years on the fire department. But I've been off the fire department 15 years. 2006. And many of the things that I think about and talk about is already 20, 30 years ago or longer or older. Time flies. That's why, to me, this is a sense of urgency, what I'm talking about. This is, I'm not, you know, I know there's plans, say we're going to do this by this day, but it is right now. In fact, hell, it was yesterday. Time is of the essence. Time is necessary to do things now. That's why at times I'm very passionate on this program about what I'm saying and what I'm hoping to do is to put something on the minds of us. Because it needs, our mind needs to look at these things now and change our behavior. Change the way we look at each other. Change the things that we have done, and better yet, begin to think about the things we must do to make that change real. I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. That's Joe Biden. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the White Citizens Council or the Ku Klux Klan, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who consistently says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically believe he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by the mythical concept of time, and who consistently advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season. All that time from when Dr. King from an economic standpoint, there could have been a lot more economic equality. But now, it's beyond. It's way beyond. The economics between us and them is so damn wide. They said it would take over 230 years. If the Caucasians was economics was frozen and ours was incrementally increased, it would take over 230 years before there was economic parity. That's how far, that's how big the gap is. When you look at economics of Caucasians who still make more than us with less than a high school diploma, and we got a college degree. Because they're the job givers, we're job seekers, and who we seek jobs from can't stand our ass. And consistently, you hear today, they're still paying them more than what they're paying us. You know? It's just that crazy. It's just that crazy. Never be afraid to do what's right, especially if well-being of a person or animal is at stake. Society's punishments are small compared to the wounds we inflict on our soul when we look the other way. I agree. But that's self-preservation is the idea here. They don't give a damn about what happens to others. You just do for yourself. To hell with others. That's what's wrong. No one really knows why they're alive until they know what they'll do to die for. What they'll do to die for. Some of the quotes of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Some of the quotes. You know. If Dr. King, you know, I always like to say if Dr. King was alive. I don't know if some of you are listening. You know, I haven't seen the Boondocks in a while, but you can go on YouTube and pull up the Boondocks. Brother Magruder's animated series with Huey and, you know, Riley Freeman, Grandpa, some of the characters, you know. And I remember that time that Dr. King was not dead. He was like in cryogenics. He was frozen. He thawed out. And so he was back in contemporary times. And he seen what was going on. He seen the foolishness that we have engaged in, how we dressed and the stuff that we've done. He was just appalled. And realistically, you could see that. You could see that. When you look at a lot of us today, our young people today. I know for those of us who are in the African-centered movement, Pan-African movement, African consciousness, you know, and we, there's a group of young people that we know in our communities. I know them in Milwaukee. I know them now here, you know, in various other places, and you're encouraged by that. I remember when I was in the 90s going to Cincinnati to the Black Men's Think Tank, you know, and seeing the students at the University of Cincinnati, you know, feeling encouraged and you know, very hopeful because of these young people and how they are and things that they're involved in and so forth. And then I guess being so optimistic, not understanding and realizing it's a small segment because the majority of us, their minds are not there. Their minds are not there. The majority of, and now, even on college campuses, you know, there ain't a lot of consciousness I got a caller, 646. 646, good afternoon on this Dr. King birthday.
Oh, see, what's popping, man? Listen, man, I wish you would really, really stop with this narrative about black people not getting paid equally to the Neanderthal. We shouldn't get paid equally to the Neanderthal. It's a damn white man's country. The white man should have the right to do what he do until somebody do what they did to get the country. It's just that plain and simple. You saw those crackers last week make a attempt for insurrection that wasn't even really dealt with on the level that it should have been dealt with if it was me and you. So, look, man, you know, it's unfortunate. It is what it is, man. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I don't give a damn about this country. So I don't get caught up in what they are supposedly going to give me or what they're supposedly going to do for me. I have to take care of my business. It's just like when these people get upset about the $2,000 and all of that. Hey, they getting it. I'm not getting it. So the bottom line is this. You got to do what you got to do, and you got to help your people. If you're not going to take care of your people and be concerned at this time about this white man, then you ain't never going to win, man. You're never going to win here. So I don't get caught up in it. I'm sorry. I don't even give a damn.
I don't either. I don't either. Jay, I give less than a
rat. No, I know what you're saying, but I get a kick. I get a kick out of the narrative when people talk about, well,
I know
white people don't pay us what they did.
Right.
Your black ass ain't fighting for nothing of no serious value.
Right, but I think that what, you know, is the consistent hypocrisy of the society when it says this and it does something else. And of course, we are bamboozled. We are, you know, led astray in believing that what the society says is truly what it means and what it does. And of course, when the reality comes out, it's not that way. And then we're all, you know, our jaws are all tight and everything like that. And, you know, but the reality is we should be like me and you. You know damn well it ain't happening. Don't even, you know, concern yourself with it. Begin to do some things to do for yourself. Begin to put into motion in your circle and around you, the reason to get the hell up out of here. To get out.
I mean,
to get out, because
now
this place will never be what it's supposed to be as long as Caucasians are breathing. I don't give a damn. I listened to a brother on the radio the other day, and he talked about, you know, the fact that Caucasians are dwindling, their numbers are dwindling, and one of the reasons why they did what they did last week, Wednesday, and so forth, they want to maintain that control. But listen, the Caucasian has always been a minority in numbers on the planet. That does not stop him from dominating and controlling wherever he is. It hasn't stopped him from doing what he's done and continues to do in South Africa and continues to do next door in Namibia. Yep. It's not going to stop him. Yes. See, here he had the numerical majority. See? And so now that numerical majority is dwindling, and now there's a Browning of America, that is not going to automatically translate into some control or something that will benefit those people. They will still be in a higher percentage in poverty. They will still be in terms of jobs and so forth, because the European has positioned himself with the economics to dominate and control. He has the wealth. He has the industry. He has the businesses. And he will have them until we change.
Well, Oshie, the way that he goes about handling his businesses,
what just happened with this piece of crap that's about to be out of office come Wednesday. Another white man, a.k.a. Mitch McConnell and his handlers, used that bastard to do what? To do the one thing that could keep the white man in power. That the courts. That's intelligence. That's how intelligence was used by the white man. He know that his numbers are dwindling. So what does he do? He go and set it up to where as legislation will be put in place to make sure that his empire and his degree of power is sustained. That's intelligence. That's how the white man is preserving
his
position in this country.
That's
and I'm saying thank you. Sweet baby white Jesus, you're doing what you're supposed to do, you filthy, no good bastard. You need to do what you need to do. You're the white man.
But you know, that's an interesting.
The white man, like Uncle Ruckus used to say.
Uncle Ruckus.
But you used the word intelligence.
That's an interesting word in this society. Because on the one hand, and that's why, to me, we really, and I did a program, early last year, whatever, on words, and words have meaning. Because you look at the word intelligence, and obviously, and I believe how you use it is being wise, is being smart, and so forth. But the other word of intelligence is covert, clandestine, undermining, and so forth. And so the word intelligence, has they used this word, just like the word discipline. You know, I hate the fact that they use the word discipline when they mean punishment, because discipline is what we must instill in ourselves. The fact that we're so out of whack is because we lack discipline. Discipline is self-controlled order. And when you don't control order on yourself, society controls order on you, imposes order on you. That's why that's why we are imprisoned. That's why we're punished. You see, and so when you use this word intelligence, the fact is that the European uses that in a covert and overt way to impose the way that he wants things to be. And you're right. It is intelligence, but it's sinister and it's evil. You know,
well, you got to give a cracker his due. You got to give the cracker his due to the fact that he's been able to sustain what he's been able to sustain for the amount of time that the no good, filthy, stinking bastard has.
No, and
to be able to just do what he do. And, I mean, it's not right.
No, it's not.
Listen, I'm not going to get all bent out of shape because this filthy dog decides that he's going to do what he do. He do what he do. He just do what he do, man.
What did you say?
You got to give the cracker some credit for what he's been able to do. Now, is it right? No, it's not right. Should he be dealt with the burning South African burning necktie all day, every day? But hey, until we make the necessary changes to dominate this filthy, stinking, no good bastard, then we just have to figure out what we're going to do.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to beg this white man for nothing. I want to see now how he's going to treat people in my situation that are at a slight economic disadvantage because of what's happening in the real estate market.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see what he's going to do in regards if he's going to do anything to help people like myself, even though, you know, I'm not in that bad of a situation because I'm in the right position to deal. But I just want to see what he's going to do to help his other white folks.
Well, they'll do whatever they have to do to maintain their position of dominance and control. Even if it means sacrificing some other Caucasians, they can give less than a rat's ass about that. That's why really You know, even though some make a big issue of the issue of the decline. I remember Ben Wattenberg's book, The Decline of the West, and I remember Pat Buchanan talking about that. And this is like 30-some years ago, maybe even longer.
I love Pat Buchanan.
You know, you like Pat Buchanan?
I love that cracker. That cracker told more truth than one could ever imagine. Oh, Pat Buchanan, you got to read his stuff. People are scared of reading him and George Wells stuff, but you got to read their stuff, man.
Well, you know, let me just say this about those who are just steeped in European Caucasian extremism, racism, and privilege, better known as white supremacy. They believe they are ordained. That they are the smartest people on the planet, that they're ordained by God to run the world, to run the planet, to whatever resources, wherever they are, it's theirs. They believe in European hegemony. What's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine. And
what you got to respect is they go about handling their business. See, I've never had a problem with Pat Buchanan. I mean, I found him to be, you know, quite interesting. I had an issue with dirtbags like Zbigniew Brzezinski. That's the type of dirtbag that I don't like. Brzezinski came to this country and waged all sort of havoc and caused so many wars and problems because of the simple fact what was done to Poland by Russia, what Russia done to the Polish. So, I mean, let's keep it real of regard people like that, but George Will and pale-blooded Americans.
All of them cats, all of them, whether they're from Europe, whether they're from him, whether they're from here, whether they're from Brazil, like Bolsonaro, all of them, they're Caucasians who believe in their supremacy and believe that they have the divine right to rule over others. They believe that the resources, wherever they are on the planet, if they feel they want them, they need them, they get them. I don't know if you heard that piece. I don't know if you heard that piece I played last week where this Caucasian is like a seminar. He has a little PowerPoint up, and the bottom line is it says that Africa must be kept poor by any means. That we must make sure that Africans never come together. Africans, and they never have the will to produce products to be in competition with us. The only thing that they want Africans to do is to get those minerals out the ground and give them to us so we can produce, so we can exploit that. And you stay poor. I mean, the arrogance of that man, I think his name was Howard Nicholas. You know, that's the part that makes me sick. I agree with you somewhat, Jay, about some of these Caucasians. But to me, I can't stand the Eric. It's like when I first saw Donald Trump many years ago, I hated his ass right away. And then, of course, all the things that subsequently have done that he has done and said that brought him to this point, I despise this man greatly. He is an evil man. And I'm hoping.
I understand what you're saying, but my issue is, Zbigniew Brzezinski should have never been allowed to come to this country and get away and cause the type of issues that he caused.
Listen,
you know what I mean?
Zbigniew
Brzezinski
was...
Because a lot of black people died because of that wicked bastard.
Well,
bullshit.
Hey, Henry Kissinger, same thing. All of them, though, Jay, to me, I don't distinguish Zbigniew Brzezinski from Henry Kissinger to Wolfowitz to all the other ones. All of them. And you might argue about to some degree or another that they are the way they are, But to me, ultimately, this is the same. It's the same Caucasian. It's the same European. It's the same mindset. They're evil. I remember, I can't remember now which general it was, but the study came out and says, because all this talk of peace, you know, and the cat came back, we can't afford peace. Peace ain't even an option. We got to have war. The military-industrial complex must maintain itself. And then, of course, it was dwindling then, because then the prison-industrial complex was coming into being. But the military-industrial complex has been there, always will be there. Eisenhower said, you got to be aware of this. The military-industrial complex is a mother. And this is what Dr. King was talking about. When you put all this money, and still today, what is the top budget figure? Who gets the biggest chunk of the budget? Exactly, the military. For what? To maintain their dominance on the planet. All the military bases around the world. 30-something on the continent of Africa. We're dealing with evil. And to me, the only thing that is logical for us as African people is to separate ourselves. Get out of this. Stop trying to reform this. Stop begging. Stop pleading. Stop marching. Stop praying. Stop all of that shit. And get your ass out.
Stop it all. I feel you, black man, though. Oh, I feel you so much, my brother.
Thank you, man. I'm very passionate on the love of us and us coming into the knowledge of ourselves and controlling our land.
Ain't nobody else care about the black man. You know what I mean? We care about every damn body else, but we don't care about ourselves on the nature that we should in regards to our survival. You know what I mean? Anytime you take the side of a white man against African on anything.
That's right. On anything.
On anything. Yep. The color of your teeth, the color of your socks, the color of anything. Like I always tell you, only thing I like white is my underwear and my socks.
Everything else
white is kind of bad for you, if you think about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I got to get my good friend, Brother Tay Jumala, on the radio with me again. He's always told me, said, everything white rejected, man. White flour, white sugar, white.
Please get him on.
Yeah, oh, Tay Ju's a jewel, man. He's great.
Ain't nothing good when it comes down to the white man.
No.
I just want to see something good about the white man. I just want to see something good that's redeeming about the cracker.
Well,
I know you're into sports a little bit, but man, I had a friend of mine call me the other night, hemming and hawing about the New York Nets and what they did, and I just had to laugh at him and tell him the Nets ain't going nowhere. Oh man, he was like he was having an orgasm on the cold. I told him, I said, boy, you really done lost your mind.
Well,
but you know, you always say,
you know,
we'll see.
I mean, the New Jersey Nets or Brooklyn, picked up, you know, James Harden. You don't know how he's going to be, but the real problem, of course, is Kyrie Irving. We don't know what his mindset is. You don't know really where he's at. He hasn't.
I think he got issues.
He's got serious issues. And then, of course.
Something wrong with him.
Yeah, and then, of course.
Something wrong with him. And, and they're trying to say it has something to do with the injustice that's going on in this country. Nah, man, he's sleeping with white women too much for that to even
you know,
stuff like that.
Yeah.
When you sleep with Becky on that level, having children with Becky and all of that, you're not duping me, bro.
Yeah. There was a party on a boat. I don't know if it was his boat, on a boat, and he didn't want no sisters on the boat. And I fact checked it because I said that can't be. And it was true. I'm like, damn, Kyrie, that's crazy. But anyway, we gotta go, man. We're up against the clock.
Captain, enjoy your weekend, brother.
You too, Jay. Peace to you. Peace, man. Brothers and sisters, thank you once again for listening. I truly appreciate you, and thank you. And I tell others, you know, and I apologize for being as emotional as I am, but damn it, this is serious. Our lives are at stake. The existence of African people is at stake. And so therefore, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., I'm your wake-up call. Brothers and sisters, we end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just to M-I-N-D, but to M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and they showing the hell, damn it, don't want to pay for it. Brothers and sisters, you have a blessed and wonderful day. Shem Hotep means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you. Bifuhodie! Bifuhodie means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. Peace, family. You have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you back here on Monday on Dr. King's commemorative day. Peace, family.